Session number 22123, move to.
Alan Mayberry, Real 2.
Yes, it was the mental aspect I found completely degrading. The task that we were obliged to do, I think, just to satisfy somebody's perverse mind. Whitewash coal, polish tin, polish everything inside, including the polished tins that we were getting the brass hoe from. Fire buckets had to be polished. The areas in front of notice boards had to be highly polished with floor polish. The notices, the day's orders, were always placed at the back of the polished square, so it was extremely difficult to get to read them, because one wasn't allowed to stand on the polished square. And all this, for me, I just found awful. And what it actually did, though, was to convince me that I ought to somehow get out of the infantry. And there really was very little way out, as I found later. But there were aspects that I enjoyed. I mean, let's not be too negative. I mean, I suddenly found I'd never fired a weapon in my life. But I suddenly found that I was extremely good and actually became a marksman, and with a rifle and a Bren gun. And I thoroughly enjoyed these exercises. And
when you refused to take the oath,
yes.
Did you have an opportunity to explain your point of view?
Yes, yes.
How did that go down?
Like a lead parachute, really. Simply because, I mean, we were there to do as we were told, and I obviously wasn't conforming. I did also, just after that, get into a further situation. When we actually finished our six-week training, because the initial training was for 6 weeks before being posted off to a regiment, we were all sent home on 36-hour leave. Now, because everybody found this highly delightful, they couldn't wait to get out. And but it was in the days of rationing. And I don't know why I'd done it. To this day, I'm amazed that I did such a thing. I went to see the training company quartermaster sergeant and asked him for my ration book. And he said, what did I want the ration book for? And I said, well, I was going home. My parents needed the rations, the ration stamps, to get rations. And I was told in no uncertain terms to go away. And I thought, well, something strange here, because we are entitled to our ration books. This is me being bolshy again. And I said, no, I'm sorry, but I do need ration books. You don't expect family to suddenly sort of find food from nowhere. In reality, I mean, my parents never suffered food-wise through the whole of the war. I mean, we were surrounded by farms and what have you, so we didn't actually need it. But I thought there was something very peculiar with all this. And so I asked to see an officer, and I went to see an officer, and I was told no, that was not the case. I'd handed over my ration book to the services, and that was it. If we wanted to see our families, then they had to find the rations to suit us. And I was sent back then to see the sergeant major, who promptly cancelled my leave. And I wasn't particularly fussed. I'll come back to that in a minute, why. But I was still very, very unhappy about why nobody was getting their ration books. And I wasn't particularly wise in streetwise in those days, but it very ultimately it dawned on me, of course, there was a huge scam going on. And the scam was that all these ration books, every time somebody went on leave, there was all these rations left over. So they were being sold on the black market by all the quartermaster sergeants. And as I subsequently found out many years after, it was a very lucrative scam. So I wrote to my parents and asked them to contact a local MP to see whether they could do anything about it, but nothing really happened. But many years after I National Service finished, I believe somebody who was a quartermaster sergeant actually admitted to the fact that this was one of the most profitable scams that was going on with national servicemen.
Admitted to whom?
I think he wrote a book or something. It came out. I remember seeing it in a paper. It was being serialised. So I thought, I was right to protest, and I wish I'd have taken it further. Why I wasn't particularly fussed about not going home was because certain aspects of the army, as I say, I was beginning to enjoy, and I realised the army did have a lot to offer. So on one of the notice boards there was, how about joining the paras type of advert. So I thought, okay, fine, you know, like to try parachuting and get what I can out of the services. So I volunteered. So in theory, what I shouldn't have actually been going on leave anyway at the end of my 6 weeks training at Borden. I should have been transferred immediately to Aldershot, to P Company, the training company at the parachute depot there. And in actual fact, that's where I went. And there was, I think there was quite a few of us. You know, I can't remember the numbers, but I guess there must have been certainly 20 to 30 of my intake all volunteered to go into the paras. And the very peculiar types, I hadn't come across these two characters before, but, sorry, I'm digressing a bit now. One of the aspects, the social aspects, I think, of national service was coming across many, many different types of people. There were people, you know, there were sort of graduates, people with good educations. And for me, something I'd never come across, never even thought about it, was people who were totally illiterate. And one of the times when I was sort of scrubbing out or cleaning out our mess, our sleeping place, I was with a little Geordie lad, and he said, could he ask me something? And I said, yes. And he said, well, he couldn't read, and he got some letters from his family, and could I read them to him? And I was absolutely amazed, because I'd never really come across anybody that couldn't read or write. I mean, my education was such that everybody was completely literate, and I'd never come across this before. And I made quite a good friend of him, because I never told anybody else. Well, he asked me not to, and of course he couldn't read and he couldn't write either. So I used to write home to his mother up in Durham. And I hope he appreciated that. Well, he also volunteered to go into the paras, but he was failed, and I think he probably spent the rest of his national service in being educated. So there was a lot of good, I think, for some people like that came out. But going back into first day of P Company, again, more shouting, more bawling. One had to run everywhere. The two guys that I struck up a relationship straight away, they were, they'd been ballet dancers. And I thought, well, how on earth are they going to survive in this environment? One did extremely well and the other didn't. He had an accident, literally falling off a wall and broke his leg, which probably ruined his ballet career. But such was the diverse population of national servicemen. I mean, you come across almost anybody, butchers, bakers, tailors, by the way, made a small fortune because they were the guys that used to tailor the uniforms. And we all used to shave the uniforms as well to make them more presentable. And have box pleats on the back of the jackets and sewn-in seams on the trousers. All good stuff to make one look a bit smarter. But anyway, one of the first things I managed to get hold of, or at least was supplied, was a decent pair of boots, because the para boots were much more supple and different to the clod-hopping boots we'd been running around with in infantry training. I don't think I have any particular memory of the pre-parachute part of the training at all. It was just really a continuum of what we'd been doing in our first 6 weeks, except it was harder. There was more teamwork, although we never kept in the same teams. The teams were juggled around all the time. And in that way, they could, I guess, the people doing the assessments could sort out the weak links, because if they moved from one team to another and they were always the weak link, then that was it. And the dropout rate was quite high, but that was generally the physical side of things. Then very gradually we got into what the paras are really all about and started to stop running, well, started to go in for the exercises of running around over high beams and what have you to make sure that you've got a head for heights and things like this. And when we finished that took about 4 weeks, I think. And then we went up to the parachute training school at Abingdon. And that's where because there was a distinct difference between just getting yourself fit to jump out of a hole and actually being taught to do so. And there the accent really changed. Although the shouting didn't, people still shouted. But at least people actually started telling you what you were doing and for why. We were introduced to the parachute. We all were taught to pack our own parachutes, although we never actually did in reality for jumping purposes, although we knew it was to show us the mechanics of how it was all done. Introductions to harnesses and what have you. The next phase was really how to control parachute. You were sort of suspended from rigs in a hangar. The hangar, as I remember, was called Casey's Gym, and it had got everything in this that you needed, other than actually jumping out of a real aircraft. They got a part of a fuselage just a few feet off the ground of a mock-up DC-3, which you were taught to lock onto the static lines and get into the various sticks were numbers of people. We were divided into sticks of 8 people, and to learn to shuffle towards the exit door, and you didn't walk, you shuffled, left leg leading and dragging the right leg. Generally, this was because, as we found out in later days, that if you were going to jump with canisters attached to you, it was usually attached to the right leg. So you got into this form of shuffling to go out. And then you just dived out onto the matting. There were loads of other bits of apparatus there. I remember the fan very well. The fan was a braking system where you actually jumped from the roof of the hangar. Had a proper harness on which was a rope, which was around a drum, and there was a fan, literally a fan attachment on the drum, so that as you jumped, the fan would start up and it would cause an air friction break. So the theory was that it gave you the same sort of velocity as a normal parachute would. And parachutes in those days, the velocity was always quite high. I mean, I'm amazed when I see how gentle people come down today. I mean, it's just like stepping off of a sort of 1 foot high chair or something. If I remember rightly, we used to come down at some horrendous rate, like about sort of 13 feet a second or something. It was something like jumping off the equivalent of jumping off of a 6 foot wall. And it could be quite painful. All this was, we spent at least 2 weeks in this gym learning all about harnesses, control of the rigging, etc., etc., before venturing out into a balloon. Before leaving Casey's gym, I remember one evening, we used to have to take it in turns to act as guard around the training school there at Abingdon, and a couple of us, we were just armed with baseball bats, I think, and we were wandering around, and we actually looked in the gym, which was totally dark, it should be, it was night, and we're just leaving, having thought everything was all okay, and somebody heard one of us heard a giggle, well, we all heard a giggle, and so we went back in, couldn't see anything at all, switch the lights on, off, still couldn't see anything. Still heard a giggle, then we realised it was coming from the roof. And we looked up only to find that one of the parachute training instructors, completely naked, had strapped himself in with one of the parachute packers, completely naked, enjoying themselves up in the... They pulled themselves up in the harness up into the roof. I've heard of some perverse ways of togetherness, but I don't think I've ever come across a more perverse way than that. So we just stayed there and admired the action. They didn't seem to be too fussed either. The next phase was balloon jumping, and the old idea of jumping through a little hole in the bottom of the cage had gone, and they were, although not that early, I don't think, or that much before us, but anyway, we were in a cage, four in a cage with an instructor, and we simply just jumped out of the door as if it was in an aircraft. For some reason, I wasn't at all perturbed about my first jump, probably curiosity more than anything. And although I had quite a good landing, nothing untoward, I was more than cautious from there on in. I think after that, every jump, I was scared was right. But not scared enough not to do it. It was... And I've always thought from there on in, if you're doing adventurous work, you need to be a little bit scared of what you're doing. Otherwise, the cowboy element takes over, and you could get yourself into all sorts of problems. The progression then, we done a couple of balloon jumps. The progression then was into jumping from aircraft. All of this was fixed line. What I mean by fixed line, the parachute release cord was attached to a line in the aircraft. So you didn't have any alternative. You jumped and the chute opened. At least the ripcord was pulled. And one hoped that the chute opened. We never had any incidents on the course that I was on. What we did have, though, was a madcap parachute training instructor, PTI. They were all RAF, by the way. They were always sergeant instructors from the RAF regiment. He was quite a large, powerful guy, flaming ginger hair. And he always used to throw out a challenge that he'd get rid of 3 sticks, that's 24 people, out of the aircraft at a couple of thousand feet. And he would still get to the ground before the first man, because he used to come out and free fall. If he got to the ground first, we all bought him a beer. If he got to the ground first, he bought all of us a beer. I think once he failed, but most of the time he ended up very happy in the evenings. So nothing really too surprising or too exciting, really. I passed out okay, and was just waiting to be posted to one of the parachute battalions, and there was a notice up that a Captain John Woodhouse would be interviewing candidates for the SAS. And I didn't really know what the SAS was all about, but I thought, well, I'll put my name down for an interview and find out. And so I went along and was interviewed by John. And he was quite interested in my background, my academic background, engineering apprenticeship, etc., my ability to climb, etc., etc. He said, "You're just a sort of young chap that we're looking for. How would you like to join?" And I said, "Yes, tell me what it's all about." And he said, it's a unit that was disbanded after the war, and it's just been started up again. He said, we've got a fair contingent of territorials in this country. He said, but the regiment has just been refounded in Malaya. He said, and I think you'll find it quite interesting. And he painted a rosy but limited picture, very craftily done, because as I thought afterwards, I never really got the picture that I saw when I got to Malaya. And the SAS in those days had no home whatsoever in the UK. The territorials had a place in London, I believe, but the main body were still using the parachute regimental headquarters at Aldershot. So I found myself then temporarily posted to the 21st SAS, the Artist Rifles, which a connotation that quite amused me at the time, thought of all these chaps going around with paintbrushes and what have you. And that's an interesting relationship in its own right. But yes, there was the selection for the SAS was nothing in comparison with what it is today. In fact, I'm sure that quite a few of us that got into the SAS in those days would never have got through selection as it is now. I mean, what it was then, as I say, was an interview with the interviewee and the interviewer coming to an agreement. If they liked each other, okay, well, go on to the next phase. And the next phase for me was attachment to the B squadron of the 21st SAS. Now, B squadron was being formed or reformed for service in Korea. And they were going out under the auspices of being termed M Force. And it was under a man called Greville Bell. I think he was a major, I'm not sure. Yes, he was, Greville Bell. Well, the week that I actually joined the 21st, M Force had left. They'd gone to, not to Korea, but to Malaya. Apparently, the Americans, who were really the controlling force in Korea, they had decided that long-range sort of clandestine operations wasn't going to work in Korea, so they stopped their own, and they then cancelled the request for the SAS to go from the UK. So B Squadron, M Force, ended up in Malaya and became B Squadron 22nd SAS Regiment. Our training did continue. We had a, I think his name was Ferguson, a captain, who organized various exercises and in introductions to various things. Explosive course I went on, a small arms course involving a whole range of small arms that I'd never even come across before. We went on to Dartmoor to do various exercises there, escape and evasion exercises. There was no way that at the end of the day you were actually going to evade completely. And I remember when I got caught, I was interrogated. One of the delightful things was being hung up by my ankles over a barrel of sludge, muddy water, and immersed head first in there, and dragged out again and told to divulge all of my secrets. Me thinking this was just an exercise, I thought, oh, they won't they won't continue this too far. To my horror, they did. I mean, I virtually passed out, and so I was only too happy at the end of the day to tell them what little I knew. And I thought, well, so much for realism. They really do play the game the hard way.
So the water went up your nose?
Oh yeah, everywhere. I was in my mouth, you know. And I mean, it was muddy, yucky water. It was more thick, you know, slimy mud than anything. That was about the worst situation that I went through. We were taught various fundamental aspects of living off the land, which, to be brutally honest, I suppose, at the end of the day, meant robbing the nearest farmyard we could find of any chickens or whatever that were roaming around. But then we went back in to do another extension to a parachute training, and this constituted a couple of recaps on daytime jumping, and then we'd done four jumps at night, and day and night jumps into water, into sea. Again, I was extremely lucky. One or two had nasty mishaps in the night jumps. I was fairly lucky. But I did then find out how hard water could be. I'd sort of dived off of diving boards when I was swimming and things like that. But of course, that was all nice and clean cut. hurtling down in a parachute, sometimes swinging in at the wrong angle and smashing either face first or whatever into water, I suddenly realised it wasn't a nice, soft medium. And one of the techniques, because you could get really tangled up in the rigging, was actually releasing all the harness but still holding on to it while you were approaching the water, and then as soon as you hit the water, letting go of everything and getting